Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We were reading the news about Netanyahu's threats and the attacks on Gaza, and then the attack happened right at our house. The roof fell on us. Our neighbors came and pulled us from under the rubble. Me, my wife, my daughters, my sons, and my wife's father.
Israeli airstrikes on Gaza killed 104 people, including at least 35 children, in the deadliest day since the ceasefire was reached. We'll get the latest. Then Hurricane Melissa's battering Cuba after devastating Jamaica, which has been declared a disaster area. It's one of the strongest Atlantic hurricanes in history. We'll speak to the Jamaican-British climate activist Michaela Loach.
This hurricane's been called Hurricane Melissa, but really it should be named after those responsible for causing it. This hurricane literally doubled in speed because of unnaturally warm seas. These seas are unnaturally warm because of burning of fossil fuels, and there are people who are directly responsible for this.
Then we speak to Illinois State Representative Han Nguyen. He says federal agents surrounded his car and pointed a gun at him when he tried to monitor a possible immigration raid.
I'm State Representative Han Nguyen. I'm State Representative Han Nguyen.
These guys are telling us to stop following.
I'm State Representative Han Nguyen.
They're U.S. Customs and Border Patrol.
I'm State Representative Han Nguyen.
There's three agents behind us. This other car behind us.
Yeah, they just put a gun at us.
Yeah, they just had a gun.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel has killed at least 104 people in Gaza, a third of them children. Journalist Mohammed al-Munirawi and his wife were among the dead. They were sheltering in a tent in Nuseirat in central Gaza. Israel's killed at least 250 journalists in Gaza since October 7, 2023. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz claimed Hamas fighters were targeted in retaliation for the killing of an Israeli soldier in Rafah Tuesday. Hamas said it had no connection to the attack. Here's Abed Awaida, a Palestinian man who lost his nephew in an Israeli strike.
They struck us at 4 in the morning while we were sleeping. They killed us, and they killed the children at 4 in the morning while we were sleeping. They struck us.
Last week, when two Israeli soldiers died in Rafah, questions were raised about whether they drove over an unexploded ordnance. According to the aid group Humanity Inclusion, clearing Gaza of these ordnances will likely take between 20 to 30 years. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Hurricane Melissa made landfall in Cuba today as a strong Category 3 hurricane, according to the National Hurricane Center. Cuban authorities evacuated 750,000 people ahead of the storm. Melissa hit Jamaica yesterday as a Category 5 hurricane, lashing the island nation with 185-mile-per-hour winds, leaving more than 500,000 people without power. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. The Pentagon confirmed Monday it carried out another three military strikes on four vessels in the eastern Pacific Ocean, killing at least 14 people. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth again claimed the boats were being used for narco-trafficking without providing any evidence. One survivor was rescued by Mexican Navy authorities about 400 miles from the coast of Acapulco, as Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said Tuesday. Her government does not support the strikes. Since September, the U.S. has carried out attacks on at least 13 boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific Ocean, killing a total of more than 50 people in strikes that have been widely condemned as illegal. The U.S. government secretly attempted to bribe an airplane pilot working for Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to help capture and turn him into U.S. custody. That's according to an investigation by the Associated Press detailing how a longtime U.S. Homeland Security investigations agent approached the pilot after learning last year that two private jets frequently used to transport Maduro were stationed in the Dominican Republic. The HSI agent, identified as Edwin Lopez, told the pilot to divert Maduro's flight to a site where he could be arrested by U.S. authorities in exchange for a multi-million dollar reward. Lopez stayed in touch with the pilot, identified as Bitner Villegas, over the course of at least 16 months. The Trump administration's accused President Maduro of being a drug trafficker without evidence, offering $50 million for information leading to Maduro's arrest in what critics say is another attempt at destabilizing Venezuela, a major producer of oil. Amnesty International is calling a U.S. strike in April on a prison in Yemen that killed dozens of detained African migrants a war crime. It followed a similar strike on the same prison compound back in 2022 by a Saudi-led coalition targeting the Houthis. Christine Beckerley, Amnesty's deputy Middle East and North Africa director, said, quote, "I didn't actually believe that it was possible that the U.S. would carry out an airstrike on the same compound, resulting in a significant level of civilian harm," she said. The U.S. federal government shutdown has entered its 29th day. The Senate yesterday failed for the 13th time to pass a Republican-backed spending bill that would end the shutdown. Meanwhile, 25 states in Washington, D.C. are suing the Trump administration over the suspension of SNAP, that Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The states are asking a federal judge in Massachusetts to order the Department of Agriculture to provide SNAP food aid benefits for November. In their lawsuit, the state officials write, quote, "Shutting off SNAP benefits will cause deterioration of public health and well-being. Ultimately, the states will bear costs associated with many of these harms," unquote. The Trump administration has vowed to not tap into a $5 billion contingency fund to keep SNAP benefits. It comes as a federal judge in San Francisco indefinitely halted the Trump administration from firing thousands of government workers during the shutdown. This is Mark Rausch, a vice president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association.
It's affecting us because we have to figure out what we're going to do with what little money we may have left in savings, or how are we going to figure out, are we going to get more money coming in? Are we going to start driving Uber? Are we going to start doing maybe DoorDash? Figure some other kind of way to generate income while still going to our jobs in air traffic control facilities and doing the work in aviation safety professions across the country without getting paid.
In Texas, Houston advocates are demanding justice after federal immigration agents reportedly beat and choked a 16-year-old U.S. citizen and his father during a traffic ambush while the two drove to school. The teen, Arnaldo Bazan, and his father, Arnulfo, were reportedly pulled over by agents in unmarked vehicles. The teen said he saw how agents kicked, punched his father, and then when he attempted to interfere, the agents also assaulted and choked him. The teen's father, Arnulfo Bazan, has been deported to Mexico. In New York, as masked agents continue to detain immigrants attending court hearings and appointments at Manhattan's 26 Federal Plaza, a dramatic scene unfolded earlier this week when a Colombian man was filmed pleading with masked agents not to arrest him before his hearing.
Don't take me like that. Please, don't be like that. Don't be like that. Dude, hey, don't be like that. Why are you going to grab me like that? Please, no. Hey.
ICE agents have also reportedly been taking entire immigrant families into custody for questioning inside 26 Federal Plaza. In more immigration news, a father from Laos has been deported despite a federal court order blocking his removal to a country he's never been to in his life. Chantila Sean Suvanavarath lived in Alabama. His wife and two children are in the U.S. According to the court filings, he was born in a refugee camp in Thailand and was granted lawful permanent residence in the U.S. before he turned 1 year old. He was detained by ICE in June in front of his two younger children during an annual immigration check-in, according to his wife. His father is a naturalized U.S. citizen, which would allow him to claim citizenship as well. In a letter from detention, he wrote, quote, I continuously lived in the United States since infancy, and I have always considered myself an American citizen, unquote. A federal judge has intensified her oversight of Trump's immigration crackdown on Chicago, now requiring top Border Patrol official Gregory Bovino to appear daily in court and to turn over all reports of agents' use of force and body camera footage. Judge Sarah Ellis also told Bovino to get a body camera to wear himself as his agents intensify attacks on protesters and bystanders during immigration raids across Chicago. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Wired reports Customs and Border Protection searched a record number of phones and electronic devices at U.S. border ports of entry over the past fiscal year. Through the end of September, border agents conducted over 55,000 searches of electronic devices without a warrant, a spike of 17%. Since Trump's return to office, people crossing through U.S. ports of entry have also reported long detention periods and being denied entry into the United States over messages on their phone. Border agents have broad powers to search and detain people, including U.S. citizens and green card holders within 100 miles of the international border, dubbed the Constitution-Free Zone. This comes amidst reports CBP is expanding its collection of biometric data of non-citizens, photographing and fingerprinting all people who enter and leave the United States through ports of entry. Meanwhile, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is replacing ICE's leadership at half the country's field offices with Border Patrol officials in regions where President Trump is demanding more immigration raids and arrests. President Trump is in South Korea for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, that's APEC, as part of the last leg of his six-day Asia trip. Trump met with South Korea's President Lee Jae-myung today, where they discussed a trade deal for securing South Korea's $350 billion investment in the U.S. Outside the meeting, demonstrators protested Trump's arrival in the country.
Korean workers believe that Korea has been under U.S. domination for a long time, since liberation. Now it is time to end that. They are angry because Trump's visit to Korea is not about attending APEC. It is about pressuring South Korea into investing in the U.S. and accepting the tariffs. That's why the workers come to Gyeongju feeling outraged about the visit.
A Reuters investigation has found President Trump's family amassed more than $860 million from sales of crypto assets in the first half of the year. Reuters detailed a Dubai meeting back in May where Eric Trump pitched investors to purchase $20 million of governance tokens in the Trump family's crypto business, World Liberty Financial. A Reuters review of the digital wallets holding large amounts of World Liberty tokens found the vast majority of them were held by overseas buyers. It comes as Donald Trump Jr. serves as an advisor to a drone company that was just awarded the Pentagon's largest ever contract to supply parts. And in Brazil, at least 64 people were reported dead during a massive raid on a favela in Rio de Janeiro. Over 2,500 law enforcement agents stormed the favela, home to some 300,000 people, as authorities claimed it's the headquarters of one of Brazil's most powerful organized crime groups. This is a cashier who witnessed the operation, described as the deadliest raid in Rio's history.
It's tense. It's very tense. I've never been through this before. I'm from Carioca, born and raised here in Rio. I live here in Rocinha, and it's chaos. So I've never seen anything like this before. It's terrifying.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Israel launched major airstrikes on Gaza beginning Tuesday night, killing at least 104 people, including at least 35 children, about a third of the dead, in the most lethal attack since a U.S.-brokered ceasefire began on October 10th. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered what he called powerful strikes, unquote, on Gaza, after Israeli officials accused Hamas of killing an Israeli soldier in Rafah. Hamas denied involvement in the soldier's death. President Trump defended Israel's attacks while also saying nothing's going to jeopardize the ceasefire. One victim of the Israeli attacks was the Palestinian journalist Mohammed al-Munirwawa, who was killed when Israel struck the tent where he and his wife were sheltering. By one count, Israel's killed over 250 journalists in Gaza since October 7, 2023. And Gaza City residents describe being pulled out of the rubble after Israel struck their home.
We were reading the news about Netanyahu's threats and the attacks on Gaza, and then the attack happened right at our house. The roof fell on us. Our neighbors came and pulled us from under the rubble. Me, my wife, my daughters, my sons, and my wife's father.
We're joined now by Mohammed Shahada, writer and analyst from Gaza, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. His recent piece headlined An Imperfect Promise, Where Trump's Peace Plan for Gaza Falls Short. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's unclear why President Trump has said that the ceasefire is not in jeopardy when Israel launched these massive strikes, killing at least 104 people. Can you explain what's happening there on the ground, what you understand, Mohammed?
Thank you so much, Amy. For me, it's basically Groundhog Day because I've been here countless times. I've lived through three Israeli wars, 10 military operations, and two ground invasions. Each single one of them ended with a ceasefire agreement that Israel violated as soon as it went into effect repeatedly. And that's exactly what we see right now happening in Gaza. Since the ceasefire went into effect over 2 weeks ago, Israel violated it about 125 times. In addition to yesterday's rampage, where the IDF killed about 100 Gazans, including 35 children. We see Israel not allowing food to go in the quantities that were agreed upon, not opening the Rafah border crossing, continuing to kill people and bomb Gaza daily under different flimsy pretexts, and continuing demolition work in over 58% of Gaza that the IDF is still occupying and declaring as, quote, an extermination zone, meaning nobody is allowed to come near that area, and anyone that tries to cross is shot at or bombed or detained immediately at first sight. What basically you have right now is Trump put Netanyahu on a loose leash with the ceasefire agreement, that the only condition is that he needs to maintain the facade of the ceasefire and not to break it with outright spectacular levels of violence. So that wiggle room is there with the leash that Netanyahu is on before Trump tries to pull him back. But Netanyahu is trying to do two things. He's trying to pull Trump towards him so that he gets an additional wiggle room. So we see him trying to come up with all sorts of bogus arguments as to why Israel needs to escalate its use of violence in Gaza. And at the same time, he's also trying to chew on the leash around his neck to break off free and restore the genocide to its full intensity, exploiting incidents like that happened yesterday in Rafah, where Israel claimed that a soldier was killed by an attack from militants, but Hamas has no ability to access that area whatsoever to launch such an attack. So even if it was a Hamas militant in that area, it sounds more like something, a situation where you have isolated, disconnected, and trapped Hamas militants in the IDF-controlled depopulated areas. So something like Vietnam or Japan, where you had soldiers stuck in tunnels or jungles that didn't know that the war was over, and they carried out and conducted or adjusted their conduct accordingly to an understanding that the war was still going on. And that's the scenario that we have now in Gaza. But Israel is capitalizing on it to claim that Hamas is violating the agreement and then resume the bombing of Gaza incessantly.
And Mohammed, as you mentioned, this is not unusual for Israel to violate these ceasefires. For instance, the ceasefire in Lebanon that's almost a year old has been repeatedly violated by the Israelis. Talk about some of your experiences in prior conflicts with these violations and how the international community virtually ignores them.
Well, basically, it was an Israeli defense minister at the time, Ehud Barak, who said after Operation Cast Lead that sign an agreement because as soon as it goes into force, nobody bothers with the details. The international community is very keen and desperate to disappear Gaza from headlines, so they are interested in the facade of the ceasefire, but not the reality on the ground. And this is exactly what Israel did after every single ceasefire they signed in Gaza, after every war or military operation that I survived. You basically had a ceasefire that bridges lifting or easing substantially Israel's siege on Gaza. But as soon as it goes into effect, none of that happens, except for some symbolic PR measures here and there, allowing a little more food to go in temporarily and then restricting it again. It's all about Israel spreading the violence across time and space, turning it into an attritional form and maintaining a low intensity attritional genocide so that it becomes almost invisible, because it doesn't make headlines when Israel kills 8 people per day in Gaza, when the standard that we got desensitized to before the ceasefire was about 100 people killed per day without making much fuss in the international community. So that's how Israel adjusts the conduct right now in Gaza. From the very moment the ceasefire went into effect, Israel has been killing on average about 8 people per day. If that happens in the U.S., you would call it a mass shooting or a massacre. In Gaza, it doesn't even make headlines.
And what about this issue of Israel still holding large swaths of Gaza as its buffer zone?
Well, basically, Israel established in Gaza a very deadly invisible barrier. That's the thing about it. It's inconsistently marked with some blocks here and there. And that barrier is deadlier than the Berlin Wall. At the time of the Berlin Wall, if you tried to cross from East Germany to West Germany, you would be shot at in the process, but you might survive. You might make it alive and make it to the other side. In Gaza, Israel split Gaza in 2 pieces. One is fully controlled by the IDF and is only populated by 4 proxy Israeli gangs. And the other side is where 2 million people are crowding in 42% of Gaza. And Israel created that invisible line that is marked sporadically with concrete blocks here and there. Anyone that comes near it, not even tries to cross that line, anyone that comes in close proximity to it is bombed, shot at, or detained by Israel immediately. There was a debate recently in Netanyahu's cabinet where Israel's security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, advocated even for killing children that come close to that line. And then another minister, Dudi M-Salem, the minister of regional cooperation, he said, those kids are coming close to the line with donkeys. Who should we shoot first? Should we shoot the donkey or the kids? That was literally the debate, the technical level of the use of violence regulations in Israel about that yellow line. And that yellow line is used by Israel now to create a Potemkin village. So on the eastern side of the line, where it's only the IDF and the gangs that are run or sheltered, financed, supported by Israel, Israel is claiming that it will carry out reconstruction in that area where no Palestinian is allowed to cross, to create a facade of reconstruction that allows Israel to then bomb, cage, besiege, and starve the other half of Gaza. So it's something that we see also in Myanmar with the Burmese genocide against the Rohingya. What the Burmese government did afterwards, around 2023, they opened what they called 2 model villages. And those model villages, they only absorbed about 500 Rohingyas. They had dwellings that did not qualify as basic homes because they didn't have any bathrooms or kitchens and did not have any ability for human habitation in terms of sustainability. But they called it a model village to create the facade that Myanmar is not carrying out a genocide, that they allowed 500 Rohingyas back into those villages while keeping 1 million Rohingyas stuck as refugees in Bangladesh. And Israel has learned that lesson and took it from Myanmar and is replicating it now in Gaza with this two-state solution inside Gaza itself.
I have 2 quick questions as we wrap up, Mohammed. One has to do with the return of the dead Israeli hostages. According to even Mossad officials, part of the negotiations over the last months, they acknowledge it would be very difficult for Hamas to find all of the remains of Israeli hostages who had died. Yet it is being used to as a pretext for the attack. The other question is the Israeli soldier who died this week, the 2 that died last week. Hamas said they weren't in Rafah. There were many questions raised about whether the soldiers had driven over unexploded ordnance. Today in our headlines, we said, according to the aid group Humanity and Inclusion, it will take decades for Gaza to be cleared of unexploded ordnance. If you could be pretty concise in your responses.
Precisely. It was the chief of the Mossad, Didi Barnea, that told Netanyahu 10 months ago that it will become virtually impossible to find the dead bodies of hostages because there's over 50 million tons of rubble in Gaza. And the UN said it would take up until the year 2050 to clear that rubble alone. It will take 35 years to gather the unexploded ordnance. The other thing about the incident in Rafah this week or last week is that there's no way of verifying the Israeli claims because they're not allowing any journalists in that area. It's just Israel's claim being taken at face value. There are many scenarios to explain this. One, as you mentioned, Amy, the soldiers running over unexploded ordnance, which was reportedly the case last week. The other scenario is Israeli soldiers having an incident of friendly fire. We saw it throughout the genocide, where the IDF would fire at fellow IDF soldiers from other battalions or other companies without knowing or identifying them as soldiers until after a disaster happens and soldiers die in that process. There's the third scenario of, as I said earlier, isolated, trapped Hamas cells that are stuck in Rafah, that don't know that there is a ceasefire in the first place, that don't know that there is an end to the war or that there's a Trump plan, that have no way of connecting or contacting the leadership in the other side of Gaza. And those militants, if they run out of food or if the Israeli soldiers come very close to the areas where they're hiding in tunnels, they would go out and engage because they would rather die in battle than die by starvation. So these are issues that Hamas and the mediators made abundantly clear throughout the ceasefire negotiations, but Netanyahu used it as a loophole to then use those incidents or those ticking bombs to point a finger at Hamas and say, look, they are violating the ceasefire agreement. I get a free hand to bomb Gaza again. So Netanyahu is trying to test boundaries. He's trying from the very first moment everything possible to resume the genocide in Gaza. It's been made clear yesterday in Israel's Channel 14. A senior former Israeli security official said that there is no intention for Netanyahu to end the genocide or the war in Gaza, that they took only this ceasefire as a chance to have a temporary pause for the IDF soldiers to refresh and for the IDF to repair and fix the tanks, the equipment, the tools that they used in the genocide, and then resume the genocide back to its full intensity. So it's a question of when, not if. Netanyahu will try everything until he gets his way.
Ahmed Shahada, we want to thank you for being with us, writer and analyst from Gaza. He's a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, speaking to us from Copenhagen. We'll continue, of course, to follow this story closely. Next up, Hurricane Melissa batters Cuba after devastating Jamaica. Back in 20 seconds. My
home, my home. I'll never fly away from here. That's my home,
my home.
Whatever I see in my dreams, that's my home. I stopped, tried to understand why I'm wrong.
My home.
I ain't gonna leave this place, 'cause that's my home.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Jamaica remains in a state of emergency after being battered by Hurricane Melissa, one of the strongest Atlantic hurricanes in history. The Category 5 storm slammed into Jamaica Tuesday with 185-mile-per-hour winds. Communication remains limited across much of the island, so the extent of the damage is not fully known. One Jamaican official told CNN there's extensive damage to homes, schools, hospitals in southwestern Jamaica. Hurricane Melissa is now battering Cuba, where it made landfall today as a Category 3 storm. Severe flooding has been reported in Cuba. The storm is expected to hit the Bahamas later today. Climate researchers say the storm was supercharged by abnormally warm waters in the Caribbean. We go now to Michaela Loach, Jamaican-British climate justice activist, the author of It's Not That Radical, Climate Action to Transform Our World, as well as the children's book, Climate is Just the Start. Michaela will be attending next month's COP30 Climate Summit in Brazil as part of Greenpeace's delegation. Democracy Now! Will be there as well, so Michaela, we'll see you there. But let's talk about this latest, one of the strongest hurricanes, most devastating hurricanes in history, has just hit Jamaica. Can you talk about what you understand with family still there? We're speaking to you in Brighton, England, but you're from Jamaica. And how this links to climate change?
Thank you so much for having me on again, Amy. It's been an awful few days. Everyone in Jamaica, my family, my friends over the last few days have been feeling just incredibly tense at this upcoming storm. Thankfully, I kind of lost contact with my family overnight and then had a lot of terrified dreams and interrupted sleep. But this morning, thankfully, I managed to get back in contact with them. And thankfully, my family are okay. My aunt's nephew's house, though, has been completely flattened by